great Krishnak that benefits. Saruman will take all that he can find. If you want anything for yourself, now's the time to do a deal." Krishnak began to lose his temper. The name of Saruman seemed specially to enrage him. Time was passing, and the disturbance was dying down. Ugluk or the Isengarders might return at any minute.
"Have you got it, either of you?" he snarled.
"Gollum, Gollum," said Pippin.
"Untie our legs," said Merry. They felt the orc's arms trembling violently.
"Curse you, you filthy little vermin," he hissed. "Untie your legs. I'll untie every string in your bodies. Do you think I can't search you to the bones? Search you? I'll cut you both to quivering shreds. I don't need the help of your legs to get you away and have you all to myself."
Suddenly he seized them. The strength in his long arms and shoulders was terrifying. He tucked them one under each armpit and crushed them fiercely to his sides. A great stifling hand was clapped over each of their mouths. Then he sprang forward, stooping low. Quickly and silently he went, until he came to the edge of the knoll. There, choosing a gap between the watchers, he passed like an evil shadow out into the night, down the slope and away westward towards the river that flowed out of the forest. In that direction there was a wide open space with only one fire. After going a dozen yards he halted, peering and listening. Nothing could be seen or heard. He crept slowly on, bent almost double. Then he squatted and listened again. Then he stood up, as if to risk a sudden dash. At that very moment the dark form of a rider loomed up right in front of him. A horse snorted and reared. A man called out. Grishnak flung himself on the ground flat, dragging the hobbits under him. Then he drew his sword. No doubt he meant to kill his captives, rather than allow them to escape or to be rescued. But it was his undoing. The sword rang faintly, and glinted a little in the light of the fire away to his left. An arrow came whistling out of the gloom. It was aimed with skill, or guided by fate, and it pierced his right hand. He dropped the sword and shrieked. There was a quick beat of hoofs, and even as Grishnak leapt up and ran, he was ridden down, and a spear passed through him. He gave a hideous shivering cry and lay still. The hobbits remained flat on the ground, as Grishnak had left them. Another horseman came riding swiftly to his comrade's aid. Whether because of some special keenness of sight, or because of some other sense, the horse lifted and sprang lightly over them, but its rider did not see them, lying covered in their elven cloaks, too crushed for the moment and too afraid to move. At last Merry stirred and whispered softly, "So far so good. But how are we to avoid being spitted?" The answer came almost immediately. The cries of Grishnak had roused the orcs. From the yells and screeches that came from the knoll, the hobbits guessed that their disappearance had been discovered. Ugluk was probably knocking off a few more heads. Then suddenly the answering cries of orc voices came from the right, outside the circle of watchfires, from the direction of the forest and the mountains. Mahur had apparently arrived and was attacking the besiegers. There was the sound of galloping horses. The riders were drawing in their ring close round the knoll, risking the orc arrows, so as to prevent any sortie, while a company rode off to deal with the newcomers. Suddenly Merry and Pippin realized that without moving they were now outside the circle. There was nothing between them and escape.
"Now," said Merry, "if only we had our legs and hands free, we might get away. But I can't touch the knots, and I can't bite them."
"No need to try," said Pippin. "I was going to tell you. I've managed to free my hands. These loops are only left for show. You'd better have a bit of lembas first."
He slipped the cords off his wrists and fished out a packet. The cakes were broken, but good, still in their leaf wrappings. The hobbits each ate two or three pieces. The taste brought back to them the memory of fair faces and laughter
and wholesome food in quiet days now far away. For a while they ate thoughtfully, sitting in the dark, heedless of the cries and sounds of battle nearby. Pippin was the first to come back to the present. "We must be off," he said. "Half a moment." Grishnak's sword was lying close at hand, but it was too heavy and clumsy for him to use, so he crawled forward, and finding the body of the goblin, he drew from its sheath a long, sharp knife. With this he quickly cut their bonds. "Now for it," he said. "When we've warmed up a bit, better we shall be able to stand again and walk. But in any case, we'd better start by crawling." They crawled. The turf was deep and yielding, and that helped them, but it seemed a long, slow business. They gave the watchfire a wide berth and wormed their way forward bit by bit until they came to the edge of the river, gurgling away in the black shadows under its deep banks. Then they looked about. The sounds had died away. Evidently, Mohor and his lads had been killed or driven off. The riders had returned to their silent, ominous vigil. It wouldn't last very much longer. Already the night was old. In the east, which had remained unclouded, the sky was beginning to grow pale. "We must get under cover," said Pippin, "or we shall be seen." "It'll not be any comfort to us if these riders discover that we're not orcs after we're dead." He got up and stamped his feet. "Those cords have cut me like wires, but my feet are getting warm again. I could stagger on now. What about you, Merry?" Merry got up. "Yes," he said, "I can manage it. Lembas does put heart into you, a more wholesome sort of feeling, too, than the heat of the orc draught. I wonder what it was made of. Better not to know, I expect. Let's get a drink of water to wash away the thought of it." "Not here. The banks are too steep," said Pippin. "Forward now." They turned and walked side by side slowly along the line of the river. Behind them the light grew in the east. As they walked, they compared notes, talking lightly in hobbit fashion of the things that had happened since their capture. No listener would have guessed from their words that they had suffered cruelly and been in dire peril, going without hope towards torment and death, or that even now, as they well knew, they had little chance of ever finding friend or safety again. "You seem to have been doing well, Master Took," said Merry. "You will get almost a chapter in old Bilbo's book, if ever I get a chance to report to him. Good work, especially guessing that hairy villain's little game, and playing up to him. But I wonder if anyone will ever pick up your trail and find that brooch. I should hate to lose mine, but I'm afraid yours has gone for good." "I shall have to brush up my toes if I'm to get level with you. Indeed, Cousin Brandybuck is going in front now. This is where he comes in. I don't suppose you've much notion where we are, but I spent my time at Rivendell rather better. We're walking west along the Entwash. The butt end of the mountains is in front, and Fangorn Forest." Even as he spoke, the dark edge of the forest loomed up straight before them. Night seemed to have taken refuge under its great trees, creeping away from the coming dawn. "Lead on, Master Brandybuck," said Pippin, "or lead back. We have been warned against Fangorn, but one so knowing will not have forgotten that." "I haven't," answered Merry, "but the forest seems better to me all the same than turning back into the middle of a battle." He led the way in under the huge branches of the trees. Old beyond guessing, they seemed. Great trailing beards of lichen hung from them, blowing and swaying in the breeze. Out of the shadows the hobbits peeped, gazing back down the slope. Little furtive figures that in the dim light looked like elf children in the deeps of time, peering out of the wild wood in wonder at their first dawn. Far over the great river and the brown lands, leagues upon grey leagues away, the dawn came, red as flame. Loud rang the hunting horns to greet it. The riders of Rohan sprang suddenly to life. Horn answered horn again. Merry and Pippin heard, clear in the cold air, the neighing of war horses and the sudden singing of many men.
the sun's limb was lifted, an arc of fire above the margin of the world. Then with a great cry the riders charged from the east. The red light gleamed on mail and spear. The orcs yelled and shot all the arrows that remained to them. The hobbits saw several horsemen fall, but their line held on up the hill and over it, and wheeled round and charged again. Most of the raiders that were left alive then broke and fled, this way and that, pursued one by one to the death. But one band, holding together in a black wedge, drove forward resolutely in the direction of the forest. Straight up the slope they charged, towards the watchers. Now they were drawing near, and it seemed certain that they would escape. They'd already hewn down three riders that barred their way. "We've watched too long," said Merry. "There's Ugluk. I don't want to meet him again." The hobbits turned and fled deep into the shadows of the wood. So it was that they did not see the last stand when Ugluk was overtaken and brought to bay at the very edge of Fangorn. There he was slain at last by Eomer, the third marshal of the Mark, who dismounted and fought him sword to sword. And over the wide fields the keen-eyed riders hunted down the few orcs that had escaped and still had strength to fly. Then, when they had laid their fallen comrades in a mound and had sung their praises, the riders made a great fire and scattered the ashes of their enemies. So ended the raid, and no news of it came ever back, either to Mordor or to Isengard. But the smoke of the burning rose high to heaven and was seen by many watchful eyes. Chapter 4. Treebeard. Meanwhile the hobbits went with as much speed as the dark and tangled forest allowed, following the line of the running stream, westward and up towards the slopes of the mountains, deeper and deeper into Fangorn. Slowly their fear of the orcs died away, and their pace slackened. A queer stifling feeling came over them, as if the air were too thin or too scanty for breathing. At last Merry halted. "We can't go on like this," he panted. "I want some air." "Let's have a drink at any rate," said Pippin. "I'm parched." He clambered on to a great tree root that wound down into the stream, and stooping, drew up some water in his cupped hands. It was clear and cold, and he took many draughts. Merry followed him. The water refreshed them, and seemed to cheer their hearts. For a while they sat together on the brink of the stream, dabbling their sore feet and legs, and peering round at the trees that stood silently about them, rank upon rank, until they faded away into grey twilight in every direction. "I suppose you haven't lost us already," said Pippin, leaning back against the great tree trunk. "We can at least follow the course of this stream, the Entwash, or whatever you call it, and get out again the way we came." "We could if our legs would do it," said Merry, "and if we could breathe properly."
"Yes, it's all very dim and stuffy in here," said Pippin. "It reminds me somehow of the old room in the great place of the Tooks, away back in the Smiles of Tuckborough, a huge place where the furniture has never been moved or changed for generations. They say the old Took lived in it year after year, while he and the room got older and shabbier together, and it has never changed since he died, a century ago. And old Gerontius was my great-great-grandfather. That puts it back a bit. But that is nothing to the old feeling of this wood. Look at all those weeping, trailing beards and whiskers of lichen. And most of the trees seem to be half covered with ragged, dry leaves that have never fallen. Untidy. I can't imagine what spring would look like here, if it ever comes, still less a spring cleaning."
"But the sun at any rate must peep in sometimes," said Merry. "It doesn't look or feel at all like Bilbo's description of Mirkwood. That was all dark and black, and the home of dark black things. This is just dim and frightfully treeish. You can't imagine animals living here at all, or staying for long."
"No, nor hobbits," said Pippin, "and I don't like the thought of trying to get through it either. Nothing to eat for 100 miles, I should guess. How are our supplies?"
"Low," said Merry. We ran off with nothing but a couple of spare packets of lembas and left everything else behind. They looked at what remained of the elven cakes. Broken fragments for about 5 meagre days, that was all. And not a wrap or a blanket, said Mary. We shall be cold tonight whichever way we go. Well, we'd better decide on the way now, said Pippin. The morning must be getting on. Just then they became aware of a yellow light that had appeared, some way further on into the wood. Shafts of sunlight seemed suddenly to have pierced the forest roof. Hallo, said Mary. The sun must have run into a cloud while we've been under these trees, and now she's run out again, or else she's climbed high enough to look down through some opening. It isn't far. Let's go and investigate. They found it was further than they thought. The ground was rising steeply still, and it was becoming increasingly stony. The light grew broader as they went on, and soon they saw that there was a rock wall before them, the side of a hill, or the abrupt end of some long route thrust out by the distant mountains. No trees grew on it, and the sun was falling full on its stony face. The twigs of the trees at its foot were stretched out stiff and still, as if reaching out to the warmth. Where all had looked so shabby and grey before, the wood now gleamed with rich browns and with the smooth black greys of bark like polished leather. The boles of the trees glowed with a soft green like young grass. Early spring or a fleeting vision of it was about them. In the face of the stony wall there was something like a stair, natural perhaps, and made by the weathering and splitting of the rock, for it was rough and uneven. High up, almost level with the tops of forest trees, there was a shelf under a cliff. Nothing grew there but a few grasses and weeds at its edge, and one old stump of a tree with only 2 bent branches left. It looked almost like the figure of some gnarled old man standing there, blinking in the morning light. "Up we go," said Mary joyfully. "Now for a breath of air and a sight of the land." They climbed and scrambled up the rock. If the stair had been made, it was for bigger feet and longer legs than theirs. They were too eager to be surprised at the remarkable way in which the cuts and sores of their captivity had healed and their vigour had returned. They came at length to the edge of the shelf, almost at the feet of the old stump. Then they sprang up and turned round with their backs to the hill, breathing deep and looking eastward. They saw that they had only come 3 or 4 miles into the forest. The heads of the trees marched down the slope towards the plain. There, near the fringe of the forest, tall spires of curling black smoke went up, waving and floating towards them. "The wind's changing," said Mary. "It's turned east again. It feels cool up here." "Yes," said Pippin. "I'm afraid this is only a passing gleam, and it'll all go grey again. What a pity! This shaggy old forest looks so different in the sunlight. I almost felt I liked the place."
"Almost felt you liked the forest? That's good. That's uncommonly kind of you," said a strange voice. "Turn round and let me have a look at your faces. I almost feel that I dislike you both. But do not let us be hasty. Turn round."
A large, knob-knuckled hand was laid on each of their shoulders, and they were twisted round, gently but irresistibly. Then 2 great arms lifted them up. They found that they were looking at a most extraordinary face. It belonged to a large, manlike, almost troll-like figure, at least 14 feet high, very sturdy, with a tall head and hardly any neck. Whether it was clad in stuff like green and grey bark, or whether that was its hide, was difficult to say. At any rate, the arms, at a short distance from the trunk, were not wrinkled, but covered with a brown, smooth skin. The large feet had 7 toes each. The lower part of the long face was covered with a sweeping grey beard, bushy, almost twiggy at the roots, thin and mossy at the ends. But at the moment the hobbits noted little but the eyes. These deep eyes were now surveying them, slow and solemn, but very penetrating. They were brown, shot with a green light.
Often afterwards, Pippin tried to describe his first impression of them.